Looking back over three decades to the publication in 1960 of my first book, I can still recapture the feeling of intense excitement when I learnt it had been accepted by Victor Galanz, whom I had long admired from afar as founder of the pre-war Left Book Club. The book was published simultaneously by Houghton Mifflin in America. I am grateful to Liz Knights, editorial director of Galanz, for reprinting Hons and Rebels and for the opportunity to comment here on some aspects of the original publication. Differences between the English and American editions, reactions of my family, and the surprising intervention of my mother, hitherto unknown to me, about the question of a title for the book. Publishers on both sides of the Atlantic tend to pride themselves on their freedom from the sort of censorship stemming from fear of persons in high places routinely exercised by the daily press. Yet looking over the two editions of my book, English and American, do I detect a certain deference to the powerful in the respective countries? Victor Galanz and Houghton Mifflin had been sent identical manuscripts. In the HM edition, following the account of my disastrous indoctrination of the dancing class children into the facts of life, occurs the sentence, "And even the king and queen do it," I added impressively. VG apparently thought this possibly offensive to the palace, so omitted it from his version. Conversely, the Galanz edition carried a quotation from Claude Coburn's amazingly influential mimeographed sheet, The Week, in which Coburn, writing shortly before World War II, pinpointed US Ambassador Joseph Kennedy as the major conduit between German military circles and Britain's then dominant Tory appeasement forces. Houghton Mifflin excised this entire passage, evidently fearing repercussions should Ambassador Kennedy's son, John F. Kennedy, become President of the United States, which indeed did happen shortly thereafter. For me, the saddest omission was made by Galanz, not for political reasons, but, as they explained at the time, for purely financial considerations. For mystifying reasons known only to the publishing trade, a few extra pages can increase the cost of production and so throw the whole pricing scheme out of kilter. Hence, they arbitrarily remove the episode of Steve Donohue's brother, mercifully replaced herewith as chapter 25. As to the family, by the time this book was in the works, I had long since made up my quarrel with Nancy over her disloyal, as I saw it, siding with the parents over my running away. I had also made my peace with my mother, whose unswerving efforts at reconciliation over the years had won me over. Towards the end of her life, we became great friends. But as Voltaire once said, qui plus ma guerre a. Having put pen to paper on the subject of my family, I was expecting a bit of a war with some of them. I was staying with my mother at Inchkenneth, her remote Hebridean island, in the summer of 1959. The contracts with Galanz and HM had been signed. What remained was for me to finish writing the book. Though wary of family sensibility, I couldn't help showing chunks of it to Marv as I wrote. She made two notes in the margin. I had said the governess's wages were £100 a year. She changed that to £150. In another passage, I had written that the bathroom in Rutland Gate Mews was dominated by a big, round, evil-smelling water heater called the Potterton. Libelous, Marv wrote in the margin, so I dutifully changed that to the Amberley. Aside from these corrections, she made no further comment. I had no idea until much later whether she did or didn't approve of my effort. At my request, Mr. Galanz had sent advance copies to all my sisters. I am rather batedly breathing to see what they think of it, I wrote to him. I figured that'd be the only way I would ever find out, as now they'll have to write to thank. But none of them did write, except Nancy. Actually, hers was the one opinion I really craved.